I'll be around no matter how you treat me now. I'll be around from now on.
You know, nobody sounds as beautiful as Frank Sinatra on a ballad. And nobody sounds as exuberant as he on an up-tempo tune. For whatever reason, he feels things more than the average human being does.
You're just too marvelous for words like glorious, glamorous, in that old standby amorous, it's all.
He had a thing that's so hard to explain. It's it. That's the one thing that puts him over the top.
So make it one for my baby and one more for the road.
His most celebrated trait was the ability to take a lyric line and, you know, treat it like Shakespeare, to act it out, to make you feel like he believed every word, and to make you believe every word, more importantly.
He had a lot of nicknames. Chairman of the Board, Old Blue Eyes, Frankie Boy, Sunatra, or simply put, The Voice. Frank Sinatra's vocal instrument made a permanent mark on 20th century America. His versions of the country's popular songs set the standard for singers and for instrumentalists. In six decades as a performer, Sinatra sang more than 1,600 different songs. In the next hour, we'll hear some of the best. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, it's Francis Albert Sinatra.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend such lonely nights. Oh, baby, lonely nights.
Trumpeter Louis Armstrong's interpretations of popular music had a profound influence on musical entertainment. He single-handedly started a new media revolution. Fledgling technologies, sound films, electronic recordings, and radio suddenly made music accessible to a much larger audience. Frank Sinatra was just a kid in Hoboken, New Jersey. Being a professional entertainer was far from his mind.
As a kid, I sang with a high school band and glee club. But I didn't have any idea of singing for my supper. I wanted to be a newspaper man. One night, I took my best girl, Nancy, to see a Crosby picture. And then and there, I changed my mind about a newspaper career.
I have given you my true love, but you love a new love. What am I supposed to do now with you now?
Bing Crosby brought singing into the modern age. His jazz sensibility and nuanced style were a perfect match for electric recording. Singer Tony Bennett.
We all teach one another. Bing Crosby taught us all how to make a living. You know, the art of intimate singing, the microphone. You know, before that it was Al Jolson or Ethel Merman, you know, where you had to belt out and hit the back of the house. It's a log that goes from one to the other, so Bing taught Sinatra.
Local radio would be the biggest boost for Sinatra's early ambition. The original Amateur Hour started in New York in 1934 and was syndicated on CBS the following year. The show offered a shot at fame and fortune to thousands of hopefuls. Its host was Major Bowes.
He was sort of a vaudeville impresario.
Sinatra biographer Will Friedwald.
And he put together these units, you know, of people that had performed on his show, and he sent them out to do vaudeville tours all over the country. And that was one of Sinatra's first sort of steps toward the big time that he played in the Hoboken Four. It was around 1935.
Shine and sway your bluesy.
Ah.
Shine, start with his shoesy.
Ah.
Make the whole world shine.
Tony Bennett.
it was the end of vaudeville as we knew it. The band business, you traveled, you went all over the world with the bands and performed everywhere. That was the greatest lesson you could ever learn.
Frank Sinatra was still scuffling for work, learning the trade, and looking for a steady gig with a band. He landed a job as a singer and part-time waiter at the Rustic Cabin, a restaurant and club in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. New York's WNEW broadcast regularly from the club. Band leader Harry James was listening in the summer of 1939. James was the star trumpeter in Benny Goodman's orchestra. He had just started his own band, and he was looking for what he called a boy singer. Frank Sinatra, a handsome 23-year-old crooner, fit the bill. Will Friedwald.
One of the questions that sort of I get asked about Sinatra all the time is, could he read music? Was he, you know, a trained musician? Did he have, you know, training? And I say it's kind of an irrelevant question, because in those days, if you wanted to be a pop singer, a jazz singer, or even a jazz musician, it wasn't like you went to Juilliard. I mean, there were, even if you wanted to do that, there was no accepted academic means of study for anything other than opera or classical music. And the way, you know, Sinatra's equivalent of going to Juilliard was, in fact, to work with the big bands of Harry James and especially Tommy Dorsey. That was his apprenticeship. That was his equivalent of graduate school.
Melancholy mood forever haunts me, steals upon me in the night, forever taunts me, what a lonely soul am I, stranded high and dry by a melancholy moon. Gone is every joy and inspiration, tears are all I have to show, no consolation. All I can see is grief and gloom, till the crack of doom, oh melancholy moon. Deep in the night I search for a trace of a lingering kiss, a warm embrace, but love is a whimsy as flimsy as lace, and my arms embrace an empty space. Melancholy mood.
Melancholy mood. Harry James and his orchestra with Frank Sinatra from 1939. Sinatra's work with the James Orchestra was beginning to pay off. He wasn't making great money, and the band was struggling to make ends meet, but the exposure was priceless. Singer Tony Bennett recalls a time when noted trumpeter Bobby Hackett saw the so-called boy singer.
He went up to Sinatra when he was with Harry James at the Astor Hotel when he had his bow tie. And Bobby went behind Sinatra and went like this to him. He pinched his cheek. And Sinatra flinched and said, "What is it?" So he said, "You're going to get so big," he said, "you're going to shiver." That's a true story.
Frank Sinatra was quickly making a name for himself. But without a hit record, opportunities were scarce for the orchestra. The closest thing to a hit was their recording of All or Nothing at All. Writer Will Friedwald.
That's one of the first examples of a singer being featured throughout a big band record, which really didn't happen. I mean, if you hear All or Nothing at All, it almost is more like Frank Sinatra accompanied by Harry James rather than Harry James and his orchestra featuring Frank Sinatra.
All or Nothing at All. Half a love never appealed to me. If your heart never could yield to me, then I'd rather have nothing at all. All or nothing at all. If it's love, there is no in-between. Why begin and cry for something that might have been? No, I'd rather have nothing at all.
All or Nothing at All, the Harry James Orchestra with Frank Sinatra.
If I didn't care, more than words can say.
Sinatra and Harry James parted ways, on good terms, by the end of 1939. Frank had been offered a job with the more established Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, and he took it.
That period of my career has kind of gone by unheralded, you might say. Because at the time, Harry was not a particularly well-known orchestra. He had just begun himself. And after singing for about 8 months with James, I was offered a job with Tommy, which I immediately accepted because at the time, Tommy was probably the number one band in the United States. Matter of fact, all over the world, I think.
Tommy Dorsey billed himself as the sentimental gentleman of swing. He was anything but. Dorsey was a showman, yes, but he was a perfectionist. He expected discipline from his musicians, and that included the singer. Dorsey's trademark, long, legato trombone phrases on the melody, pointed the way for a dedicated pupil like Sinatra. Sinatra biographer, Will Friedwald.
Dorsey was very, very much a role model for Sinatra in every aspect of making music and, in, you know, like I say, just living one's life and having one's career. Even in the way he played trombone and his approach to melody was a major influence on Sinatra, probably the single most important one. And Sinatra always gave him credit for that.
A country dance was being held in a garden. I felt a bump and heard an, oh, beg your pardon. Suddenly I saw polka dots and moonbeams all around a pug-nosed dream. The music started, and was I the perplexed one? I held my breath and said, may I have the next one? In my frightened arms, polka dots and moonbeams sparkled on a pug-nosed dream.
Polka Dots and Moonbeams, from the essential Frank Sinatra with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. The Dorsey Band played music everywhere, on the radio, in the ballrooms, at the recording studio. Dorsey's arrangers wrote for dancing, and the ensemble was very popular with foxtrotters. Sometimes, though, the music was purely sentimental. Will Friedwald.
The biggest hit of the bunch was a very offbeat record for the swing era, and it doesn't even really sound like the swing era. It sounds like it's from some completely, you know, if you never heard it before, it's called I'll Never Smile Again, and if you never heard it, you would think it's from some whole other period in musical history, just because it doesn't sound like, you know, Benny Goodman. It doesn't sound like Count Basie. It doesn't have this sort of driving dance beat, which is very unusual. But again, it's sort of an early example of Sinatra going for this very intensely romantic, intimate sound.
For tears would fill my eyes, my heart would realize that our romance is through. I'll never love again. I'm so in love with you.
Frank Sinatra singing his biggest hit with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, I'll Never Smile Again, from 1940. Sinatra's star was rising fast. When the Dorsey Orchestra played ballrooms like the Paramount Theater in New York, teenage girls were coming to the shows in droves. Sinatra's good looks, skinny build, and dreamy voice were the main attraction. So in 1942, Sinatra struck out on his own. Will Friedwald.
It was not an easy split. It's a very complicated issue about how Sinatra not only managed to leave the band but to get out of his contractual relationship with Tommy Dorsey. It's a very complicated issue that scholars have been working on for many years trying to untangle that one.
Nancy Sinatra.
It was over a third of his income that was sort of held hostage by Tommy Dorsey, for the rest of Frank's life, which I thought was just horrendous. And it was handled by, the breaking of the contract was handled by the top agents and lawyers in the business in New York. And what they did was they reminded Tommy Dorsey that he liked broadcasting on NBC. And these people represented NBC. And they said, if you want to continue to work for NBC, you're going to have to let this guy go.
Sail ever and ever so sweet, ever and ever so sweet, just like an old valentine.
On September 3rd, 1942, Tommy Dorsey did just that.
Folks, this is Frank Sinatra's farewell broadcast with his band. After tonight, he's going to be strictly on his own. And Frank, I want to tell you that everyone in the band wishes you the best of luck.
Thanks, Mac, and I'd like to say that I'm going to miss all you guys after kicking around for 3 years.
Frank, before you hit the road, how about one more song just for Auld Lang Syne?
That's all right with me, Tom. Give me the beat on our arrangement of the song as you, and I'll see what I can do with it.
I hear music when I look at...
From then on, Frank Sinatra was on his own, for better or for worse. Just ahead, Sinatrama, the singer goes solo. This is Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. You can find us on the web at npr.org and on the air from NPR National Public Radio.
It's more than I could bear to find that I'm forsaken. If you're a fantasy, then I'm content to be.
Welcome back to Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson, with more on The Voice, Frank Sinatra.
I hear music when I look at you.
In 1942, Sinatra left the steady paycheck of Tommy Dorsey's orchestra for a shot at the big time. And in a few months, he would be the hottest act in the country. But business was quiet at first, until Sinatra got himself booked back into the Paramount Theater in New York City. Will Friedwald is the author of Sinatra, The Song Is You.
After he left the band, the first important booking he had, and sort of the one that really made him, was at the Paramount Theater. And it's notable in that it's sort of the first instance of teenagers, and it was principally teenagers, literally going crazy, not just as an expression, but literally going crazy in terms of swooning, screaming, yelling, tearing up the theater, breaking down the seats, you know, teenage kids getting hysterical. And that had never happened. I mean, nothing even remotely like it had ever happened. I mean, as big as, you know, other singers had been, Bing Crosby or Al Jolson, it was never that specific kind of a reaction. And it really anticipates, you know, in a very direct way, what would later happen for Elvis Presley and the Beatles and the whole rock and roll thing, where, you know, music at that point was specifically targeted to teenagers. And even though Sinatra wasn't doing that, I mean, his music appealed to adults as well as to kids, he definitely had this sort of hardcore audience of teenagers. And, you know, the reaction was something that the music business had never seen.
The Bobby Soxers' reaction earned Sinatra a new nickname, Swoonatra. The Columbus Day Riot of October 1944 was the most famous event. School was not in session, and more than 30,000 girls showed up for Sinatra's show at the Paramount. Sinatra mania was everywhere. The suave singer tapped into a lovesick audience, and he had the cure. Sinatra fired romantic ballads with deadly precision.
I fall in love.
too easily. I fall in love too fast. I fall in love too terribly hard for love to ever last. My heart should be well schooled, 'cause I've been fooled in the past, and still I fall.
Frank Sinatra, I Fall in Love Too Easily, from a Columbia recording in 1944. Girls were swooning, the nation was at war, FDR was the president, and Frank Sinatra was the king of pop.
And now for all you men in the armed forces who happen to be 13-year-old girls, we bring you your one and only singing favorite, the first atom ever split, Frank Sinatra.
Thank you. That's a very peachy introduction, Dad.
Peachy?
So only 13-year-old girls like me, huh?
That's what I hear.
All this stuff about 13-year-olds and me is just plain propaganda. I know one beautiful movie star who goes for me, and she isn't 13 either.
Really? I didn't know Lassie cared.
Well, she does.
Yeah, come to think of it, Frank, why shouldn't Lassie love you?
Sure.
That's a great thrill for a dog, hearing a pile of bones sing.
That's Bob Hope and Frank Sinatra, entertaining American GIs. Sinatra was everywhere. Movies, radio, concert halls. His recording career at Columbia also marks some of his finest interpretations of popular song.
All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? Take my lips, I want to lose them. Take my arms, I'll never use them. Your goodbye left me with eyes that cry. How can I get on, dear, without you? You took the part that once was my heart, so why not take all of me?
Taken from the box set The Columbia Years, All of Me. Charles Granata was the project director for this collection.
Sinatra was at Columbia from 1943 until 1952, and during that period, he developed his true song styling. I mean, Sinatra became a song stylist. He wasn't just another singer. And people really recognize Sinatra as a ballad singer. And I think the one ballad that I love that really typifies Sinatra as a ballad artist at Columbia is his version of Body and Soul.
My heart is sad and lonely. For you I sigh, for you, dear, only. Why haven't you seen it? I'm all for you, body and soul. I spend my days in longing and wondering why it's me you're wronging. I tell you, I mean it. I'm all for you, body and soul.
Body and Soul, Frank Sinatra, featuring trumpeter Bobby Hackett.
Sinatra may have left the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, but the band still had a huge impact on his development.
There was an arranger with Tommy named Axel Stordahl, and when I left Tommy, I had to convince Axel to try to take potluck with me, as it were. And he did, and we grew together, you might say, for about 5 or 6 years, or even longer than that. And Axel, he did wonderful, wonderful things for me, and untold inspirational arrangements and great orchestrations. He was essentially a composer. I don't mean that he composed music as a job, but when he arranged for me, the backing was almost like a separate composition.
Axel Stordahl set Frank Sinatra's golden voice to lush string arrangements. Their collaborations were pure magic.
If I don't see her each day, I miss her. Gee, what a thrill each time I kiss her. Believe me, I've got a case on Nancy with a laughing face. She takes the winter and makes it summer, but summer could take some lessons from her. Picture a tomboy in lace. That's Nancy with a laughing face.
Nancy with a laughing face. Frank Sinatra, with help from arranger Axel Stordahl, singing the praises of his then 4-year-old daughter. Tony Bennett.
It was a dance era. You had to be as good as Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire. Or near it, anyway. When you did a ballad with long lines, very long lines, so that you'd have a nice tempo going and you could dance a nice foxtrot to it, you know, hold the girl real close and dance. And a lot of people got engaged that way, you know, and it was a different era. It was a sweet era.
It was Sinatra's era.
I'm not coining any phrases when I say that here is one of the really great men of show business. The mayor of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Mr. Louis B. Mayer.
Thanks, Frank. Let me return the compliment. Let me welcome you to the MGM family.
I'm proud to be in that family, sir.
My other reason for coming over here tonight, Frank, is to tell you that the readers of Modern Screen magazine have confirmed our judgment of you at MGM. The readers of Modern Screen have chosen you as the most popular film star of 1946. The honor bestowed last year on Van Johnson.
Hey, Van, you better move over, son.
The award is this bronze bust of yourself done by the great American sculptor Joe Davidson, the artist who has sculpted Franklin Roosevelt, Madame Chiang Kai-shek, Premier Clemenceau, and other famous people.
Thank you sincerely, Mr. Mayor. This is going to be a hard guy to live up to.
You can be proud, Frank, proud as we are of you. Remember, we at MGM can only choose the personalities to present to the public, and they let us know whether or not we have chosen wisely. It is the fans who make the stars, and such a tribute as this award voted by them is an honor indeed.
Mr. Mayor, I'm sincerely grateful to you and to Modern Screen Magazine, especially to the readers of Modern Screen Magazine who have put me in the ball game with Van Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and thank all of you.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing, everything that traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low,
Even with a turkey that you know will fold, you may be stranded out in the cold. Still, you wouldn't change it for a sack of gold. Let's go on with the show.
But the good times were quickly ending for Frank Sinatra. Sinatra's quick temper and inquisitive celebrity journalist were a volatile combination. The press pounded him for leaving the mother of his children and pursuing actress Ava Gardner. His associations with the mafia were speculative, but damaging. Songs that made the hit parade had less substance, and Sinatra's romantic singing style was soon out of place. Will Friedwald.
And I think that what really happened was that audiences had started to tire of that sound. I mean, what Sinatra had been in 1944 to 1946, he was still doing the same thing in 1948 and 49, when perhaps he should have moved on. And it was a lesson that he learned because, you know, his audiences started to desert him, and he lost his record contract wasn't renewed, neither was his radio show, and neither was his film contract.
Sinatra's career hit bottom. Rarely does America give celebrities a second act. But Sinatra would be back, and better than ever.
Let's go on with the show.
More on that in a minute. I'm Nancy Wilson. It's Frank Sinatra, this time on Jazz Profiles. You can find us on the web at npr.org. And on the air from NPR National Public Radio. Welcome back to Jazz Profiles from NPR. I'm Nancy Wilson, and we're examining the career of Francis Albert Sinatra.
You vowed your love from here to eternity. A love so true, it never would die.
In the early 1950s, Frank Sinatra's star power was fading. After a string of failures, he landed a supporting role in a major film, From Here to Eternity. Sinatra's dramatic performance of the character Maggio earned an Academy Award. Will Friedwald.
It's very symbolic that he dies in the film, because I think that his fans or the general audience sort of took that as a way that he was doing penance. It's a very Catholic kind of a thing. You know, he was paying for his former sins by dying in this movie. And at the same time, what's really just as significant as From Here to Eternity is the song Young at Heart. If Eternity is his comeback movie, then Young at Heart is his comeback song. And again, it's very significant in terms of the content of the song, because it's essentially a song about starting over.
Fairy tales can come true, it can happen to you, if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind, if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh when your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way.
Don't you Young at Heart, Frank Sinatra. By the end of 1953, Sinatra had an Oscar and a hit record. He was the comeback kid, Tony Bennett.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a great confidence, you know, and then From Here to Eternity, that winning the Academy Award, and you get this, well, I've arrived, you know, that kind of thing. It's not a conceited thing. It's just that now I know what to do with an audience. I know just what they want.
Frank Sinatra had recently signed with Capitol Records, a label that had a roster of singers, including Nat King Cole. At Capitol Records, Sinatra created some of the greatest vocal albums of all time. And again, another alum from the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra played a key role, none other than Sinatra's legendary arranger, Nelson Riddle.
When I went over to Capitol Records, Nelson was what they call the house arranger. He was writing for practically everybody, all of the singers on the label. And we got started pretty good, and we just left it that way.
One of the first Sinatra-Riddle collaborations was the concept album Songs for Young Lovers.
My story is much too sad to be told, but practically everything leaves me totally cold. The only exception I know is the case when I'm out on a quiet spree, fighting vainly the old ennui, and I suddenly turn and see your fabulous face. I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true?
I get a kick out of you. Frank Sinatra with arranger Nelson Riddle. Author Wilt Friedwald.
When you think of Sinatra, you think of what he achieved with Riddle. I mean, that is the definitive Sinatra sound. You think of those 16 or so classic albums that they made together. That's, you know, when you hear Sinatra's voice in your head, usually you hear it to a Nelson Riddle orchestration.
You make me feel so young. You make me feel so spring has sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual.
Sinatra and Riddle worked methodically. They planned songs around a theme. Sinatra usually selected the music in advance, picked the key he wanted to sing in, and sketched an outline with Riddle. The arranger would then take those ideas and commit them to paper. I've Got You Under My Skin was an exception. It was one of four songs that Sinatra recorded with a single day's notice. Frank Sinatra Jr.
So Nelson is in the back seat of his family station wagon with a leaf from the dining room table across his knees. Nelson's writing the parts. They get to the studio, and I think he wrote a score because he didn't have room for the parts in the car. The copyists grab the score, and they've got a room off the studio with about eight copyists sitting there. And while they recorded the first three, they finally then got to the last one. And when they were finished, the whole orchestra applauded for Nelson. They couldn't believe it.
Frank Sinatra called I've Got You Under My Skin Nelson Riddle's finest hour.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you in the heart of me, so deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know so well I've got you under my skin.
I've Got You Under My Skin, Frank Sinatra, from the 1956 recording Songs for Swingin' Lovers, Will Friedwald.
Sinatra was really the first guy to take love songs specifically and do them in a way that was rhythmical and swinging, but not lose the fact that it was a love song, to still have the romantic element and to still be erotic and sexy and romantic, and but to do it as you know, in a jazz tempo, to make it swing, just bringing it to a place where it had never been before.
Nelson Riddle was Sinatra's go-to guy, but the singer could also swing to the beat of another great band orchestrator, Billy May. Again, Will Friedwald.
There's a feeling of whimsicality, capriciousness, that's in everything he does. And the records that he made with Sinatra, particularly Come Fly With Me, Come Dance With Me, Come Swing With Me, you can see there's a pattern here. That suits Sinatra to a great deal. And Come Fly With Me is like one of the great, perfect Sinatra records, particularly, you know, the title song, which opens with what sounds like a plane, you know, coming down the runway. You know, he's able to paint that image in your head, you know, just with the orchestration. And it's a beautiful piece of work.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away.
Come Fly With Me, Frank Sinatra with arranger Billy May in 1957. Frank Sinatra's capital years brought everything together. Great American songs, classic orchestrations, and an interpreter of the highest order. By this time, Sinatra's sound had changed. His easy, mellow voice grew rough around the edges. He had more than a decade of singing behind him, and ballads now came from a world-weary voice of experience.
The ballad albums get increasingly profound, and by 1955, when he made In the Wee Small Hours, you just don't get a more sort of honest presentation of, you know, how the American songbook can be sung, particularly in terms of, you know, bringing yourself into it and using what you have of yourself to make the song that much more believable. And Sinatra was the all-time master at that, at you know, making you think that the song was a slice of reality, you know, making you think that whatever song it was, that it was his story, that it was his personal history.
In the wee small hours of the morning, while the whole wide world is fast asleep, you lie awake and think about the girl and never ever think of counting sheep. When your lonely heart has learned its lesson, you'd be hers if only she would call. In the wee small hours of the morning, that's the time you miss her most of all.
Frank Sinatra, In the Wee Small Hours, from 1955. Frank Sinatra called the album Only the Lonely, a collection of suicide songs. Nelson Riddle's spare orchestration adds a sense of quiet desperation to Sinatra's already dark and brooding vocals. This album should be listened to by prescription only. It is achingly beautiful. And when the twilight Tony Bennett.
He just understood life, and he was very, very deep about, he saw the reality of what was good and what wasn't. I think just from life, you know, the school of hard knocks. Great school, if you could survive it.
When I want rain, I get sunny weather. I'm just as blue as the sky. Since love is gone, can't pull myself together. Guess I'll hang my tears out to dry. Friends ask me out, I tell them I'm busy. I must get a new alibi. I stay at home and ask myself, who is he? Guess I'll hang my tears out to dry.
Guess I'll hang my tears out to dry. Frank Sinatra sings For Only the Lonely, from 1958. In a sense, popular music had to go someplace else. Sinatra's output on Capitol Records was, in many ways, the final word of the era of popular songs defined by Tin Pan Alley and Broadway. The era of what we still call standards would soon give way to the new music called rock and roll. The writer David Haydu put it best. To hell with the calendar. The 20th century dies when Frank Sinatra dies. For many, the 20th century ended on May 14th, 1998.
It's the last dance. We've come to the last dance.
Songwriter and longtime Sinatra colleague, Sammy Kahn.
Sinatra is recalling this song. And I had lines that they're wondering just when will we leave, but till we leave. So he said, they're wondering just when we will leave. I said, no, it isn't. Fine, hold it. I said, they're wondering just when will we leave, but till we leave. He said, what kind of cockamamie word is... I said, no one speaks like that. I said, no. I said, no one speaks like that. But we aren't speaking, Frank, are we? We're singing, aren't we, Frank?
It's the last song. They're playing the last song. The orchestra's yawning.
Our program on Frank Sinatra was written and produced by Joshua Jackson. Special thanks to member station WBGO Jazz 88 in Newark, New Jersey. Thanks to Michael Bourne, Paul Chufo, and Christine Jackson. Special thanks to WHYY's Fresh Air with Terry Gross for the interview clips with Frank Sinatra and James Isaacs. NPR's Jazz Profiles was created by Tim Owens. Our series producer is Soraya Muhammad. We had engineering help from Flawn Williams and Sherry Hendrickson at NPR West. Our technical director is Neil Tivolt. NPR's Director of Music Initiatives is Benjamin Rowe. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is Jazz Profiles from NPR, National Public Radio.